Chapter 5. Highness Sir Armaduke. At midnight, local time, a new star woke in the skies above Anzimar. The city's population was hurrying to attend the day's Sabbat Libera Nos service, which had been held in the temples of the Beati every midnight since the crusade began, in the hope of vouchsafing a brighter tomorrow. Some of the hundreds of thousands of citizens bustling from their homes, or even their beds, or suspending their labour, at that time, may have turned their eyes skywards. For since the very origin of the species, mankind has entertained the notion that some ineffable source of providence may look down upon us. The upward glances were vain, involuntary wishes to glimpse the face of salvation. No one saw the star light up. The smog that night was as thick as rockcrete. Ship bells rang. At high anchor, at the edge of the Mesopause, the Imperial Tempest-class frigate, Highness Sir Armaduke, lit its plasma engines. The drives ignited with a pulsing fibrillation before calming into a less intense, steady glow. Below the ship lay the troposphere and the stratosphere. The shadow of the Terminator lay heavily across Menazoid Sigma, and the smog atmospherics were so dense that there were no visible light concentrations from the nightside hives. Part of the world was in sunlight. The fetid clouds, brown and cream, looked like infected brain tissue. Small ships buzzed around the Armaduke like flies around a carcass. Fleet tenders nestled in close to its flanks. Launches, lighters, cargo boats and shuttles zipped in and out. The Armaduke's hatches were all wide open, like the beaks of impatient hatchlings. Entire sections of the frigate's densely armoured hull plate had been peeled back or retracted to permit access. The old ship, ancient and weathered, looked undignified, like a grandam mamsel, caught with her skirts hoisted. Above the ship lay the exosphere. The vacuum was like a clear but imperfect crystal, a window onto the hard blackness of out-system space and the distant glimmer of tiny, malicious stars. The Highness Sir Armaduke was an old ship. It was an artefact of considerable size. All ships of the fleet were large. The Armaduke measured a kilometre and a half from prow to stern, and a third of that dimension abeam across the fins. Its real space displacement was 6.2 megatons, and it carried 32,411 lives, including the entire Tanith First and its regimental retinue. It was like a slice cut from a hive, formed into a spearhead shape and mounted on engines. It was built for close war. Its hull armour was pitted and scorched, and triple thickness along the flanks and the prow. The prow cone was rutted with deep scars and healed damage. The Armaduke was of a dogged breed of Imperial ship that liked to get in tight with its foe and was prepared to get hurt in order to kill an enemy. To Ibrahim Gaunt, closing towards it aboard one of the last inbound launches, the ship had the character of a pit fighter or a fighting dog. Its scar tissue was proud and deliberate. Like the ritual marks of a blood-pacted soldier, he reflected. The plasma engines pulsed again. Hold doors began to seal, and cantilevered armour sections extended back into position. Gaunt's craft was one of the last to enter the central landing bay before the main space doors shut. The swarm of small ships dispersed either into the Armaduke to share its voyage, or away to planetside, or the nearest orbital fortress. Formations of Fury and Faustus-class attack craft had been circling the ship at a radius of 500 kilometres to provide protection while she was exposed and vulnerable. Now they formed up to provide escort. Buoy lights blinked, lines detached, fleet tenders disengaged and rolled lazily away, like spent suitors or weary concubines. The Armaduke began to move. Initial acceleration was painfully slow, even at maximum plasma power. It was as though an attempt was being made to slide a building a basilica, a temple hall, by getting an army of slaves to push it. The ship protested. Its hull plates groaned, its decks settled and creaked. Its superstructure twitched under the application of vast motive power. The other ships at high anchor unhooded their lamps to salute the departing ship. Some were true giants of the fleet, grand cruisers and battleships 6 or 7 kilometres long. Their vast shadows fell across the Armaduke as it accelerated along the line of anchorage. To them, it was a battered old relic, an orphan of the fleet they would most likely never see again. The Fury Flight dropped in around the ship in escort formation. The plasma drives grew brighter, their flare reflecting off the noctilucent clouds below, creating a shimmering air glow. Mesospheric ionisation caused Bow's bright lightning to dance and flicker along the Armaduke's crenellated topside, until the advancing ship passed into the exosphere and the wash of the magnetosphere's currents swept the light show away. Stepping out of the launch into the excursion hold as the ship ran out, Gaunt sampled the odour of the vessel's atmosphere. Every ship had its own flavour. He travelled on enough of them to know that. Hundreds, or sometimes thousands, of years of recirculation and atmospheric processing allowed things to accumulate in a ship's lungs. Some smelled oddly sweet, others metallic, others rancid. You always got used to it. A 10 or 12 week haul on a shift ship could get you used to anything. The Armaduke smelled of scorched fat, like grease in a kitchen's chimney. He would get used to that. You could get used to the smell, the chemical tang of the recycled water, the oddly bland taste of shipboard food. You got used to the constant background grumble of the drives, to the odd noises from a vast superstructure constantly in tension. Once the drives were lit, the hull flexed. Once the Geller field was up and the ship had translated into the warp, the hull locked tight, like a well-muscled arm pumped and tensed. You got used to the acceleration sickness, the pervading cold, the odd, slippery displacement, where the artificial gravity fields fluctuated and settled. Once translation had been achieved, you got used to the ports being shuttered. You got used to ignoring whatever was outside. You got used to the baleful screams of the Empyrean, the sounds of hail in the hull, or burning firestorms, or typhoon winds, of fingernails scratching at the port shutters. You got used to the whispers, the shudders and rattles, the inexplicable periods of half-power lighting, the distant subterranean banging, the dreams, the footsteps in empty corridors, the sense that you were plunging further and further into your own subconscious and burning up your sanity to fuel the trip. The one thing you never got used to was the scale. At high orbit, even with the vast extent of a planet close by for contrast, a starship seemed big. But as the planet dropped away to stern, first the size of an office globe, then a ball, until even the local sun was just a fleck of light no bigger than any other star, the embrace of the void became total. Space was endless and eternal, and the few suns no bigger than grains of salt. Alone in the bewildering emptiness, a starship was dwarfed, diminished until it was just a fragile metal casket, alone in the monstrous prospect of night. The Armaduke was accelerating so robustly now that the fighter escort was struggling to match it. Course was locked for the system's Mandeville point, where the warp engines would be started up to make an incision in the interstitial fabric of space. The warp awaited them. The crew and control spaces of a starship tended to be kept separate from the areas used for transported material and passengers, even on a military operation. The transporters and those they were transporting needed very little contact during a voyage. But the Armaduke was still 26 minutes from the translation point when Gaunt presented himself to the shipmaster. He did not come alone.
"No entry at this time," said the midshipman, manning the valve hatch.
He had 6 armsmen with him, all with combat short weapons for shipboard use. Gaunt showed the midshipman his documentation, documentation that clearly showed he was the commanding officer of the troop units under conveyance.
"That's all very well,"
said the midshipman, displaying that unerring knack of Navy types to avoid using guard rank formalities.
"But the shipmaster is preparing for commitment to translation. He can't be interrupted. Perhaps in a week or so, he might find some time to..."
"Perhaps he's done it 1,000 times before," said Gaunt's companion, stepping out of the bulkhead shadows, "and doesn't need to do more than authorise the bridge crew to execute. Perhaps he ought to bear in mind that his ship is a vital component of this action and not just a means of transportation. Perhaps you should open this hatch."
The midshipman went pale.
"Yes, sir," he said,
his voice as small as a shift ship in the open void. The shipmaster's name was Clemensu Spica. He had 3 battle fleet commands behind him, but his career was in decline. A grizzled man of medium height, who conducted his command in full dress uniform, he was standing proudly at the gilded rail of the upper deck platform when they entered, gazing out across the bustling main bridge towards the vast forward viewer with a noble expression on his face. Gaunt wondered if he'd been standing there anyway, or if he'd struck the pose when he heard they were coming. He turned as they came up to him, looking Gaunt in the eye, then tilting his head up to look at the Silver Guard warrior beside him.
"We're underway," he said. "Could this audience have waited?"
"No,"
said Edwine.
"Is this translation especially problematic?" asked Gaunt.
"No,"
replied Spiker. He gestured for them to follow him and instructed his first officer to watch the steersman. At the back of the upper deck was a small stateroom reserved for briefings or quiet counsel. Spiker sat and indicated they should do the same. Edwine remained standing. Apart from one wall panel that displayed a detailed summary of ship function, the room was decorated with painted sections, framed in scrolled gilt. Each painted panel showed a different view of Kulan, the regal palace, the waterfalls at Hipson, the tombs at Kalil, the imperial lodge in High Askian, the Smarnian Basilica.
"You understand how your vessel will be engaged in this venture?"
asked Edwine. His augmetic rasp had little colour or tone.
"Of course," replied Spiker. "Rendezvous at Tavis, son. Resupply. Then direct to the marginals."
"I mean there," said Edwine. "In the marginals."
"Boarding action," said Spiker.
"I understand."
"You will be required to stay on station," said Gaunt.
"I know."
"There will be no fleet support,"
Gaunt added.
"The Armaduke will be vulnerable."
"I know,"
repeated Spiker.
"There are several things we don't know,"
said Edwine.
"The dangers are considerable. We will be running silently for the last real space section. There will be navigational hazards. Clearance and manoeuvre will be restricted. The deployment will be multi-point, sustained. We do not know what we will find inside the target structure."
"At all?" asked Spiker.
"I understood that this mission was based on the intelligence of..."
"It is," said Gaunt.
"But it is limited. It may be out of date."
"It may be a pack of lies,"
said Edwine.
"Encouraging," said Spiker.
"Depending on levels of opposition, you may be required to commit your armsmen,"
said Edwine.
"I wasn't told that,"
said Spiker.
"Is it a problem?"
"The armsmen of the Highness Sir Armaduke will fight for the life of the ship if necessary," said the shipmaster firmly.
He paused.
"But I have been given a complement of young recruits. Few have battle experience. I was given to expect that you'd be doing the fighting.
Gaunt glanced at the towering space marine. Edwine's helm hung from his belt. He was looking with what resembled interest at the paintings of the waterfalls at Hipson.
The Navy has been economical with your briefing, said Edwine. What do you understand this mission to be about?
About a matter of strategic importance, replied Spiker. Specifically, from my point of view, the opportunity to put this newly refitted ship and its young crew through a proper shakedown prior to recertification.
Neither Gaunt nor Edwine replied. Spiker looked at them. There was something infinitely sad in his pale blue eyes, as if he'd been trying for weeks now to overlook the obvious.
A cynic might, I suppose, interpret this differently, he said.
How might that go? Asked Gaunt.
An expendable and not entirely void-worthy ship and a young crew of little experiential value, said Spiker. Given into the charge of a man who will never make Admiral now and who asks the wrong questions of his superiors. A mission that is so likely to end in disaster, only scraps can be risked.
A good dose of cynicism is always healthy, I find, said Edwine.
There were other clues, said Spiker, a hardness in his voice. He looked at Gaunt. I reviewed your file. Those sections that were not restricted. Glorious moments early on, at Balhout especially. Great favour. The achievements since have been considerable. I mean that. No one could fail to be impressed by your service record. But recognition has been scant since Balhout. There is a sense that you have squandered great opportunities and ended up achieving little credit for the expenditure of great courage and tenacity. Like me and my ship, you and your regiment are useful, but disposable commodities.
A good dose of cynicism is always healthy, replied Gaunt.
I don't care who you are, rumbled Edwine. I don't care if you're the War Master himself. This is the Imperium of Mankind. We're all of us disposable commodities.
The lights dipped. There was a shudder. The warp embraced them.
I hate that, said Larkin.
He froze and refused to continue walking until the ship lights returned to their original brilliance. There was an underdeck tremor, a distant exhalation.
Worst part of any trip, he added.
The lights came back up, a frosty glare in the low deck companionway. He started walking again.
The worst? Asked Domer.
Yes, said Larkin. Apart from getting there.
All true, said Domer.
They had reached the armoured hatchway of a hold space, originally designed as a magazine for explosive ordnance. Ron and Brosten were waiting for them.
I want a badge like that, said Larkin.
Well, you can't have one, said Brosten. It's only for the kings.
The kings can kiss my arse, said Larkin.
Domor looked at Ron.
This could continue all day, Major, he said.
And it still wouldn't become amusing, Ron agreed.
Gaunt wants us to see him, said Domor.
Is that all right?
Yes, said Ron, provided you're who you say you are.
Larkin winked at Rowan.
Come on, Eli. He'd be pretty rubbish disguises, wouldn't he?
What are you suggesting?
Asked Domer, a smile forming.
We forced our own faces to change shape.
I've seen stranger things, said Rowan.
Nobody here is surprised, said Larkin.
Rowan nodded to Brosten. The big man banged on the door, then opened the outer hatch.
Coming in, two visitors, said Ron over his microbead.
I read that.
A peephole slot in the inner door opened, and Ron stood where the viewer could see his face. The inner hatch opened. Ron took Domor and Larkin through.
Got anything he could use as a weapon? Asked Ron.
My rapier wit, suggested Larkin.
Mabon Etigor was sitting in a folding bunk in one corner of the dank magazine compartment. The walls, deck and ceiling were reinforced ceramite, and the slot hatch for the loader mechanism had been welded shut. The prisoner was reading a trans-missionary pamphlet, one of a stack in his mattress. His right wrist was cuffed to a chain that was bolted to a floor pin. Varel was sitting on a stool in the opposite corner, his las rifle across his knees. Kant was standing in another corner, nibbling at the quick of his thumbnail. Larkin and Domor came in and approached the Ektagor. He looked up.
"I don't know you," he said.
"No, but I had you in my crosshairs once," said Larkin.
"Where?"
"Balhut."
"Why didn't you take the shot?" asked Mabon.
"And miss a touching moment like this."
"That's Domor. That's Larkin," said Ron, pointing.
"Don't tell him our damn names," Larkin hissed. "He might do all sorts of faithed-up magic shit with them."
"I won't," said Mabon.
"He won't," Ron agreed.
"He can't," said Varel.
"Why not?"
asked Larkin.
"Because how else would I be the punchline for another of Al's jokes?" asked Kant wearily.
Larkin snorted. "He won't, because he's cooperating," said Rowan, ignoring the others.
"And if I did," said Mabon, "Rowan would gut me."
"He does do that,"
Larkin nodded.
"What did you need from me?" asked Mabon.
"A consultation," said Domor.
He had a sheaf of rolled papers under his arm and a data slate in his hand.
"Go on," said Mabon.
Larkin took the pamphlet out of Mabon's hand and glanced at it.
"Good read,"
he asked.
"I enjoy the subject matter," said Mabon.
"A doctrine of conversion to the imperial creed?"
asked Larkin.
"Fantasy," replied Mabon.
"He'd be a fethin' funny man if he didn't scare the shit out of me,"
Larkin said to Rowan.
"We're leading the insertion effort," said Domor. "There's training to be done, planning. We want to use transit time to get as ready as possible."
"Are you combat engineering?" asked Mabon.
"Yes," said Domor. Larkin, he's marksman squad."
"I saw the lanyard."
"We want to go over the deck plans and schematics you've supplied so far. It may mean several hours' work over a period of days."
"I'll try to build time into my schedule."
"Some of the plans are vague," said Larkin.
"So are some of my memories." "It's all from memory."
"If you go through them a few times," said Ron, "maybe you can firm things up?" The Ettigor nodded. "If you go through them so many times you're sick of them, maybe we'll actually do this right," Ron added.
"I've no problem with that," said Mabon.
"I offered this to you. I want it to happen."
Domor showed him the data slate.
"We want to talk about this too," he said.
"This firing mechanism. We need to mock some up for practice purposes. You say this is fairly standard?"
"It's representative of the sort of firing mechanisms and trigger systems you're going to find," said Mabon, studying the slate image.
"It's just mechanical," said Larkin.
"It has to be. They can't risk anything more complicated. They can't risk using anything that might interfere with, or be interfered with by, the devices under development at the target location. It's delicate. Any conflict in arcane processes or conjurations could be disastrous."
"So, just mechanical,"
said Larkin. "Complex and very delicate. Very sensitive. But yes, just mechanical."
Larkin took the slate back.
It looks very much like the sort of thing we use," he said. "It looks pretty standard."
"It's the sort of trigger mechanism I would rig," Domor said.
"Of course," said Mabon. "Tried and tested guard practice. This is the sort of thing I taught them how to do, and I learned it the same place you did."
Larkin looked at Domor, There was distaste on his face. "Go get the folding table," Ron said to Varl. "Let's look over these plans." In Berthinghold 6, the lights stayed dim for a long time. When they came back up, it was without enthusiasm. The air was foggy. Too many bodies, too much breathing, not enough decent atmospheric processing. "This is a dump," remarked Ree Perday. The cots were stacked three deep and close together. It was a forest of prone bodies. There was virtually no room to stow the band's instruments.
"Well, it's our dump," said Bandmaster Yerolimu, moving through the rows.
He tapped an empty bunk with his baton.
"Who's not here?"
"Paul Corran, Sergeant Major," said Goris.
"Where is he?"
"Acceleration sickness, Sergeant Major," said Perday.
"Corran doesn't get acceleration sickness," said Yerolimu.
"He does this time," said Erish.
"White as an undershirt," muttered Goris.
"Not one of your undershirts," said Perday.
"Settle down," said the bandmaster. "Maybe the bandsman needs to see a medike," asked Commissar Blenner. He'd been watching from the end of a bunk row.
Didn't see you there, sir," snapped Yerolimu, straightening fast.
The others began to move.
"Please don't," said Blenner, coming forwards.
He took off his cap. It always took the sting out, he thought, when the cap came off.
"This isn't an official inspection. I just came to greet you. Make sure you were stowed."
"That's kind of you, sir," said Yerolimu.
"I can afford to be kind now, Sergeant," said Blenner. "You can pay me back later by behaving yourselves."
He crooked an eyebrow to the crowd and got a little chuckle.
"You'll find I'm a pretty fair sort, generally. Come to me in good faith and I'll always hear you out. Thank your lucky stars, my name's not Hark."
More laughter, and it was genuine.
"Anything to report so far? The facilities suiting your needs?"
"Pardon me, sir," said Perday, "but there's precious little room to store our instruments."
"No, there isn't, is there?"
said Blenner, glancing around.
"Gaunt said something about storing them. Where was it now? Airgate 60.
Still more laughter, some of it outraged.
I know, said Blenner. "No respect, is there? No respect for the simple, pure, uplifting decency that is a colours band. Am I right?"
It seemed he was.
"I tell you what we're going to do," he said. "This mission, it's pretty vital. It's dangerous too, I won't lie. What we're going to do is spend the time proving that a marching unit is indispensable to the regiment. Indispensable. As soldiers and as musicians, you're going to prove your worth."
That got a big cheer.
"Fury of Belladon!"
Blenner tossed in for good measure, and circled his raised hand like a potentate on a balcony taking a march past. As they began to settle again, he turned to the Sergeant Major.
"I was looking for your commanding officer," said Blenner.
"I can show you to his quarters," Yerolimu replied. "I was just settling the company."
"You carry on, Sergeant Major," said Blenner. "I'm sure somebody else can show me. That young girl, for example. She seems very accommodating."
"Perday," called Yerolimu.
"Sir, yes, sir.
Kindly show Commissar Blenner through to Captain Wilder's quarters."
Perday jumped up.
"This way, sir," she said.
She led him off the bustling berthing deck and onto a rather more gloomy corridor where the officers had been given cabins. The deck was a mesh. Below there was a maintenance trench and a sluice.
"What's your name, trooper?"
asked Blenner.
"Ree Perday, sir."
"Ree? Ree? And what's that short for?"
"Ree, sir."
"I see," said Blenner.
Not one to be deflected, he pressed on.
"And where are you from, Ree Perday?"
"Belladon, sir."
Yes, silly of me to ask. In the shadow of a maintenance hatch in the trench below, the thing with Paul Coran's face watched them pass overhead. He had hidden so he could relax the tension in his face again. Bones clacked as cranial kinesis reasserted Coran's visage.
And what was that?
Asked Glenner.
I didn't hear anything, sir, said Purdy.
I hope it wasn't rats, said Glenner.
I do hate rats.
Oh, yes, sir.
Especially when you spot them leaving the ship first.
Purdy laughed and knocked on a cabin door. It was open.
Sir? Captain?
She called. She peered inside.
Oh, throne,
he heard her say. Glenner pushed past her. The cabin was small and unfriendly. Wilder was sprawled on the deck. He had been sick at least once. The smell of Amasek was pungent. Glenner rolled him over. He was bonelessly limp, but he was still breathing. There were fumes coming off him you could have lit with a lucifer.
Oh, you bloody idiot,
Glenner muttered.
What do we do, sir?
Asked Purdy.
Go get a mop, Purdy, and a pail of water, said Glenner. Don't tell anybody why. When you come back, watch the door and don't let anybody in.
She looked at him, helpless and anxious.
Go on!
She hurried out. Glenner sighed and then hoisted Wilder up and carried him over to the bunk. He groaned in his stupor.
I could just shoot you for this, you realise that, said Glenner.
Wilder opened his eyes, but there wasn't much of anything in there.
You're a bloody fool, said Glenner. I gave you a chance tonight and you've already screwed it up. There's going to come a point when I can't help you any more, do you understand?
Wilder closed his eyes.
Can't and won't, said Glenner.
Purdy reappeared.
Where's the mop girl?
Glenner asked.
Sir, I was just looking for one, but I thought you should know. Company inspection, sir. Company inspection right now.
Throne, Wilder, you'll be the death of me, said Glenner.
He got up.
Purdy, use the jug of water there and get a spare shirt or vest out of his hold all. Try to mop up this mess. Quickly now.
Yes, sir.
Glenner put his cap on and went to the cabin door. Baskerville, Sloman and Eder had just appeared at the end of the corridor, walking, talking.
Glenner, said Eder, I was going to invite you to join us, but I couldn't find you.
I was already inspecting,
Glenner said. He pulled the cabin door shut behind him so they couldn't see in past him.
Inspecting? Asked Eder.
More a meet and greet. I didn't know a surprise formal was due. Standard Belladon practice to spring a surprise on a new intake during the first 36 hours, said Baskerville. Perhaps you should familiarise me with some standard Belladon practice, said Glenner, seeing as the Belladon are my special responsibility.
Yes, of course, said Baskerville. I didn't mean to cut you out of the process. I should have consulted you.
No harm done.
Would you like to walk in with us now? Maybe Captain Wilder, too.
Glenner pulled a face. He dropped his voice and leaned in close.
There's a slight problem, he said. The captain's been struck down with a nasty bout of acceleration sickness.
Really?
Said Baskerville.
Nasty,
Glenner nodded.
It's widespread, actually. More than one bandsman's got it. I'll be sending for a medicaid to give everyone a check. The thing is, Wilder could join us, but he looks like death warmed over, and frankly, I don't want him losing face by seeming weak in front of the men.
Quite right, said Sloman.
Here's an idea, said Glenner, his voice still low. Why don't we do the inspection once I've had everybody checked? Give them a fighting chance to turn out properly in a first show. I mean, come on, between us, they're not going to get a fighting chance to do anything much more impressive, are they?
Sloman laughed. Baskerville tried not to.
That's good policy, I think, said Eder solemnly. This time tomorrow, maybe.
They went back the way they'd come. Glenner stepped into the cabin. He breathed deeply and quickly necked one of Dorden's pills.
Perdée had done a good job of washing the deck. She was bagging the shirt she'd used for the laundry.
"You're a kind man, sir," she said. "You said you were fair and you clearly mean it. Others would have hung the captain out for this."
"Don't tell me that," said Blenner. He pointed at Wilder. "Tell him that when he wakes up tomorrow morning."
"The shipmaster seems reliable," asked Lord Militant Cyborn. "This Spiker, he was the Navy's choice."
"He seemed agreeable enough," said Gaunt. "Sanguine." Cyborn nodded.
"I'm a sec."
"I'll take a small one, sir." Cyborn's staterooms were some of the most comfortable passenger apartments on the Armaduke. Gaunt believed a senior helm officer had been rehoused to accommodate the Lord Militant for the voyage. Gaunt had opted for a standard officer's quarters of the lower deck beside the other Tanith seniors.
"Should I have seen him? He knows I'm aboard,"
said Cyborn as his aide marched off to get some Amasek. The Lord Militant eased his augmetic frame down into a reclining flight throne. His chamber's desk was alive with hololithic displays. Cyborn liked his information fresh and frequently renewed.
"I think I made the right noises," said Gaunt, taking the small Amasek that the aide offered him.
The glass was from the Lord Militant's own travelling case. There was a small rook crest etched in the crystal.
"He knows you're aboard, but it's not general news," Gaunt went on.
"And you'll be leaving us when we rendezvous with the fleet at Tavis Sun. So Spiker needs to get used to me being the voice of authority." Cyborn nodded and sipped his Amasek pensively.
"You took a space marine with you?"
"Edwine, of the Silver Guard."
"Sensible. That'll put the wind up him at least."
There was a long pause.
"Times are changing, Gaunt," said Cyborn. His augmetic voice was a soft rumble.
"Sir?"
"It's been a long time since Balhut. Moods change. Fortunes shift. People go in and out of favour."
"This has always been my experience, sir," Gaunt said. "Were you saying this in relation to anything particular?" Cyborn shrugged. Augmetics hissed. He steepled his fingers around his glass, gazing at it.
"You and I were ascendant at the same time, Gaunt. Before Balhut, under Slado. It was a good time for us. We were connected."
"We were. I don't feel I've been unfairly treated since."
"I don't feel you have either," said Cyborn. "You made your bed. You looked at the opportunities and you decided to stay in the field. You've made the best of that choice. Throne knows some part of me wishes I'd made similar choices at certain points in my career."
"Your career and command are enviable, sir. And it's far from over." Cyborn nodded.
"If this mission goes well, Gaunt, it could mean a lot. It could mean a lot for the cause, but also for you and for everyone who supported the effort."
"Which would include the War Master?"
"Naturally. But I doubt he's paid close attention to this one. Do you know how many missions he is required to scrutinize and approve every day across the sector? Come on. This is one raid, part of a sequence in a corner of the Sabbat worlds, not seen as directly strategic. If it fails, it's forgotten. If it succeeds..."
"It could make a man's career,"
It could make the careers of many men gaunt. It could alter the emphasis of operations. It could provoke an overhaul. A much-needed overhaul.
I see. Saibon wiped his lips with the back of his finger.
I will remember you for this, Gaunt. I will credit you where credit is needed. I hope you will do the same.
Of course. Saibon looked at Gaunt.
It's already begun, you know,
he said. Sir?
4 weeks ago, unadjusted, the first attack. There have been 7 more since. In the space of these 6 months, sidereal 28 raids will take place at selected locations across the trailing portions of the Sabaad worlds. All of them will work according to the philosophy cooked up by you and Mercure. The tactics, the clues left, the information broadcast. Some of those transmissions are very authentic.
They're as authentic as we could make them, said Gaunt.
28 raids, said Saibon. It's not even a massive commitment of men and material. Nothing so grand the War Master has to approve resourcing. The coordination, that's the clever part. It's smoke and mirrors.
It's mostly smoke and mirrors, sir, said Gaunt. The effect will be very diluted if we don't pull off this attack.
Then that's what you'd better do, isn't it?
Said Saibon. Meritus Felix Chass had taken a seat in the corner of Gaunt's quarters and was reading a data slate. He got up when Gaunt walked in. Gaunt gestured to him to sit again.
Ravenor, said Chass, indicating the book. I've never been particularly taken with his work.
Really? Said Gaunt.
He died badly, didn't he? Gaunt shrugged. What matters is what he did first, he said. He sat down at his desk. Madalena, dear beloved, was a silent presence in the far corner. You can always wait outside, said Gaunt.
He doesn't leave my sight, she replied.
I have a problem here, said Gaunt. You tell me you're my son. That's both a surprise and a hindrance to a man in my particular circumstance. I don't mean to be a... What do you mean to be? Asked Gaunt. My mother thinks it would benefit me, as a future leader of House Chass, to learn from you.
Learn what? How to fight? Honour? Duty? You can learn all that from her.
My mother?
No. Her, said Gaunt, pointing at the lifeguard. But let's talk about your mother for a moment. According to you, you're her first and only son. That makes you heir to the house. Why is she risking your life like this? First sons, sometimes second sons too, they're kept closeted in protective custody to safeguard the bloodline. Getting sent out into the Imperium is usually the fate of subsequent offspring.
Vergestite philosophy is somewhat different, Madalena began.
I wasn't talking to you, said Gaunt. He was immediately annoyed with himself for snapping. He didn't know what it was, but the lifeguard really got under his skin.
House Chass has always believed in experiential improvement, said Chass. To see the Imperium, to learn about it, to learn from my father, these are all things that will benefit me when I finally take my place.
Your mother has never travelled, not as far as I know.
She would have, said Chass, but she may be required to assume the house sooner than expected. My
My grandfather is ill. I didn't know. I'm sorry. Gaunt got up and began to pace thoughtfully. I'm afraid I think this is about prestige, he said. You associate with the famous war hero of Vervenhive and earn some glory of your own. You'll go back as more than just a popular heir to the house. That kind of borrowed gloss will get you a planetary seat, a governorship. I think House Chass has great ambitions to fulfil through you.
You are dismayingly arrogant, said Madalena.
Just tell me I'm not also right, said Gaunt. There was a knock at the door. Madalena instinctively reached towards her sidearm.
Don't even think about it, said Gaunt.
Enter! Beltane came in, with Nahum Ludd and Trooper Darlin.
You sent for these men, sir?
He asked.
I did. Come in.
You might as well stay in here this too, Beltane. Chass had risen to his feet. Both Ludd and Darlin looked at him, curious.
This, I have just discovered, is my son, Gaunt said. He ignored their looks of surprise. I didn't know I had a son, and now I find myself compromised by the knowledge. This is a risky mission, and potentially none of us may come back. Taking the son I've just met along on what could be a suicidal venture hardly seems like the greatest exercise in parental responsibility.
Gaunt looked at Ludd and Darlin. However, I could hardly leave him behind on Menazoid Sigma either. He wants to join us. He wants to serve with us. That's a reasonably admirable ambition.
I don't want special treatment, said Chaz.
Good, because you're not getting any, said Gaunt. Ludd, I hate to add to your existing workload, but I want you to prepare and process enlistment papers. If he wants to be a guardsman, it had better be official.
And I take it you want me to keep an eye on him too, sir? Asked Ludd.
No, not at all, said Gaunt. I want you to keep an eye on her.
He pointed to Madalena.
The young Lord Chass here, said Gaunt, is noble-born. He has a bodyguard, a good one. It's the only special favour I'll show him, allowing her to remain. She can look after him, but she will not get in the way of operations. The moment she does, you can remove her. My full authority, you can shoot her, if needs be.
He can try, said Madalena.
Ludd is an Imperial Commissar, Gaunt said to her. If I were you, I wouldn't even think bad things about him.
He turned back to the others.
His lordship must not compromise my decision-making, especially not on this mission. I cannot, will not, worry about him, or second-guess my choices because of him. Darlin, you're about his age, so I want you to show him the ropes. There's no time for basic and induction. Let him shadow you, and teach him what he needs. I ask this as a favour, not a command. When the real fighting starts, we'll be keeping him away from the brunt of it.
I want to...
Chass began. Enough, said Gaunt. Show him the ropes, please, darling. But I don't want him even compromising your duties as adjutant. He eats and sleeps like any common lasman.
He should receive a rank, said Madalena. Some privilege for...
If he wants to learn from me, said Gaunt. He can do exactly what I did, and start from the bottom, take it or leave it. You asked for this, so don't complain, now you've got it. If he doesn't like it, he can leave us at the fleet rendezvous and go home to his mother.
He looked at them.
That's all.
McCall, chief scout of the Tanith First, prowled silently through the vast and dark cargo decks of the Armaduke. He was hunting. The engines rumbled distantly. He hadn't set out to look for anything in particular. He just wanted to get the lay of the land, learn the geography of the ship. Just in case. He also wanted to get his equilibrium settled as fast as possible. Ship time unsettled him. He got through it by walking and learning every obscure corner of whatever craft he was aboard. It was a form of meditation. Half an hour into his first walk around, crossing a vehicle deck where mission equipment was secured under lash lines and the air smelled of disinfectant, he'd first seen the bird. It was moving through the cargo galleries, swooping from one set of hold rafters to the next. It looked as lost
and as trapped as he felt. He set to following it. It was big, a twin-headed eagle. At first he wondered if it was some kind of vision, but it was real enough. He'd been told the intake had brought a cyber animal aboard with them, a mascot. It had evidently got loose. It kept a pace of him. He followed it through two of the small holds, then around an engineering deck where the few servitors didn't seem to notice it. It avoided the busy spaces, the troop decks, the vast and heated furnace rooms of the drive chambers where hundreds of crewmen toiled like slaves. Like him, it sought the lonely parts of the ship. He wondered how he could catch it without harming it. If it stayed loose, it could get lost or trapped and die of starvation. The death of an Aquila on the eve of a mission would not be the best omen. McCall followed the bird into a vast hold space that had been left empty. Junk and spare plating had been piled up there. He heard a voice call out. The eagle turned, surprised, and then immediately followed the voice down. It settled on a metal spar beside two figures. They were sitting right out in the middle of the empty space, perched on scrap metal, a small fire burning in an oil can. One of the men was Ezra Knight. He was permitting his companion to examine the function of his rainbow. Ezra saw McCall and called out,
"Hist ye soul, come join yerin."
McCall walked over to the fire. The other figure lowered the rainbow and looked McCall up and down. He was a space marine of the White Scars chapter. He was in full plate, his helm on the deck by his left foot.
"You are master of the scouts?"
he asked.
"I've heard all about you. Sit